they go in the woods and they're like, we're gonna go, you know, find this grizzly bear. And they head out there, and this is the first time they ever see a grizzly bear. And they're like, all right, great. And one of the guys, we don't know who, shoots the grizzly bear, and it charges them. And they shoot it again. Grizzly bear's not caring. Goes.
Hello and welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, a podcast that digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. I'm Kyle, short round to Eric's Indiana. We're using the power of economics to defeat Nazis everywhere. And if you made it this far, you did it, because today we get to take a break from criticizing Jefferson and instead get to spend all our time in the Lewis and Clark expedition. Which, speaking of which, Eric, where do you want to start? Cap Dubois, maybe? Or...
well, I was going to say, I do think bringing up the word Nazi in the first 5 seconds of a YouTube video will certainly help the algorithm.
Well, I mean, it's got to help, right? I mean, right. Anytime you can work in an Indiana Jones reference, I'm just going to take it. I can't help myself.
Oh, I do love Indiana Jones. Jefferson makes Louisiana purchase, and he's like, I want to know what I bought. Which is really irresponsible if you think about it.
Yeah, yeah. The time to do that would have been before you ponied up $15 million, but yeah.
Yeah. At least he charged them 20% of it for privateering fees that the French still owed us.
What is this line item? Oh, that's our scouting fee.
That's correct. Nickels and dimes, France. Yeah. Nickels and dimes, Napoleon. Napoleon got hosed in this. Like,
oh, God.
Yeah. Oh, he might have, like, oh, he was a good general, but, you know, that strawberry blonde tall man from Virginia really took him to the washer. It was really just good job. So it starts in 1804. So it starts actually very, very soon after the Louisiana Purchase, which is kind of cool because...
When was the purchase finalized?
Mid-ish to late... The Treaty of Session, it was like mid-ish to 1803.
Okay, so it's pretty quick afterwards.
Yeah, which is kind of funny because as we talked about last week... We didn't really, it wasn't like this was on the market, you know, there wasn't a for sale sign, in New Orleans on this.
I know, right? Where'd you even stick that sign?
Send us an email with where you think we should, the sign should go, and I will pay to have a for sale Louisiana Purchase sign installed wherever it comes up.
Just I'm a giant billboard right on I-40.
I am 100% serious. I will order from Amazon one of those little, like, for sale signs in front of a house, and we will figure out where to put it.
Can we put Napoleon's number on there?
Yes, I will find somebody named Napoleon, and I will give him some probably small amount of money and a Google phone number.
Nice.
All right, we got to figure that out. how we're doing this, but we're doing this.
All right.
So it's kind of cool. They put it together. They didn't know how long it was going to take, so it ended up taking 2 years, from 1804 to 1806, for them to get to the West Coast and back. Nobody knew it. Nobody knew how long it was going to take. Nobody knew really.
They didn't even know which way to go to get across, right? I mean, they spent a lot of their time scouting rivers and just kind of mapping them all out.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Kyle, you bring up something interesting. You said mapping out rivers. And that's really what this was. Jefferson wanted, you know, this scientific expedition. Don't get me wrong. But it was more about finding the famed Northwest Passage. So if they could find a sea route from... the Mississippi River all the way to the Pacific Ocean. Mm. So it's important to remember they did know, like, they had an idea of where the Pacific Ocean was. Don't forget, there's a lot of trading going on this time, and the Spanish had colonies on both sides of the American continent, so they knew it was there. This isn't, don't think it's Columbus being like, oh, wow, there's an ocean over here. Like, they didn't know this.
Right, yeah.
and so its primary goal was to map the tributaries of Mississippi River. And it did that pretty successfully, but it was also a scientific journey.
He was like trying to catalog plants and species, like the trees and that kind of stuff too, right?
Yeah, it was. He wanted to categorize all the fauna and flora out there. And what's kind of I kind of really like about this is it was not done for like any military reason. It was done for purely economic and scientific reasons. And I think we can see that the official name of the group that went out there was the Corps of Discovery.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome. That's like so
right?
Cool.
I want to be in that group.
Yeah, right. Does that sound fun? So they end up leaving in May of 1804. And it took them from May of 1804 to November of 1805. Like, that's crazy. So think of that. It took them about 18 months to get out there and only 6 months to get back.
Why did they start in May?
Yeah, horrible time to start, by the way, right?
Wouldn't you start like a little sooner, like right as like the thaw's like kind of hitting, like March maybe?
Yeah, I very much agreed. And they left from St. Louis, so like it's pretty. You could leave from St. Louis in March. Like, I think that's probably a pretty
I guess one. So.
Yeah, and then they ended up finishing up in Fort Clapsop in Oregon, which we'll get to it. But it was actually there was a very famous moment in the history of democratic elections that occurred at that fort. Where to begin with the craziness of this story? The story honestly sounds made up. Like,
yep, I know.
Like, 1,000 years from now, they'll be like, was there really a Lewis and Clark expedition?
Let's talk about the main constituents then. So you have Lewis, you have Clark. Who else are the major players that are kind of in this group? Sacagawea, obviously.
We got Sacagawea. I want to bring up. I actually have a roster of everybody who was officially listed on the Lewis and Clark expedition. Now, it's important to remember that porters and stuff like that aren't on here. But I do want to be. There were other people involved, but these are the main characters. You have Meriwether Lewis. Dope first name. Don't know why that name ever fell out of style. Right. I will petition Tiffany to see if we can name our first son or daughter Meriwether. I think you can use it both ways. I don't know.
I mean, Floyd Mayweather's, close.
Yeah, close. Yeah. All right, so you had Meriwether Lewis. He was obviously one of the co-captains of the expedition. By the way, they used the term captains in expeditions at this point in history, which I think is super cool.
I thought it was hilarious that they were co-captains.
Yeah, co-captains, like co-popes. And,
right.
Like co-generals. What's crazy is all these people are super young. He's 30 when he goes out here.
Dude, 30 is ancient frontier land, though. That's honestly, the grizzled vet. Yeah.
Honestly, like valid point. So he was a frontiersman. He was an army officer. He was Thomas Jefferson's personal secretary, which I don't know why I like that so much. It's like your personal secretary. But I just want to remember this time period. These aren't like office secretaries, admin assistants. Meriwether Lewis was an accomplished, had a large array of scientific knowledge, and he had accomplished leadership skills. He knew what he was doing. And so his job was to oversee all the scientific observations, the mapping, and journaling. My word, was this man a prolific journaler. Like, you could see how intelligent he is reading through his journals and reading through, different books on him. Is that he took so many notes. Absolutely so many notes. The other gentleman, who was 34 at the start, is William Clark. And he had a pretty cool background. So he had a pretty prolific military career, but he was an expert cartographer, and the occupation that keeps popping up, he was a surveyor.
Surveyors and cartographers. Yeah. Country was built on them, right?
Like, literally. Yeah. Like, and his job was to map out these new lands. And there were several other expeditions that happened afterwards that all mapped out different areas. His job was to figure out if there's a way to get to the Pacific Ocean from the Mississippi River. It was going to be William Clark who was going to map it out. That's also his cartography skills were so developed that that's why they were able to get back so quick. They had basically had a
perfect they had way a map to follow.
Yeah, that they had a very accurate map. And he did something kind of cool. Is he managed a lot of the logistics of it? And he kept very detailed notes too. Meriwether Lewis's notes were exceptional. They were like textbook. They look like textbooks. But William Clark kept a pretty robust journal. But at the outstretch of the party leaving, he was actually the guy in charge. I'm not joking. Like, in charge of relations with Native Americans. Which is going to be very awkward when we talk about the most famous person.
Sacagawea.
Who probably is one of those, like, right person, right time, people in American history.
That doesn't, that kind of sells it a little short. I don't know.
Yeah. it does, Kyle.
This is like the most serendipitous moment, I think, in history that I've ever seen.
Yeah. Kyle loves Sacagawea. Big Sacagawea fan.
This whole expedition was doomed if not for her.
Right. Yeah, I always remember when I was growing up, the TV show Hey Arnold had a song, a blues song about Sacagawea. Yeah, that was, I don't know if anybody in their 30s remembers Hey Arnold having that song, but it's always stuck in my head whenever it comes on.
Which
and
one?
I'm not going to sing it. I'm not singing it. That's I will find a link to it, and we can drop it in there. So she was a Shoshone.
Did you say Hey Arnold, though, like the old Cartoon Network show?
First off, it was Nickelodeon. How dare you?
Nickelodeon, yeah, okay. Yeah.
She was a Shoshone, but she had been kidnapped by another Native American tribe when she was a kid, and she was later sold to her husband.
Yeah, it was like a French... He was the cook, right, for the
Chabonnet.
Expedition.
Yeah. Toussaint Chabonnet. But yeah, I think sold to your husband's very problematic.
It's not normally the type of phrase that goes into like the wedding handouts.
Yeah. Oh, yes, exactly. And so she was 16 when she left for the expedition, and Sacagawea, being the boss she is, was pregnant when she left with her son Jean-Baptiste. So you got this like pregnant woman who's just an absolute boss. She's like, I'm going to drag this expedition to the end, whether or not you like it. And the coolest U.S. corn, in my opinion, because it has those weird sides to it. I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah, that's when they tried to bring the dollar back, right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Now, people for some reason think they're worth more than a dollar. I'm like, it's a bit weird. She actually saved them so many times. So many times. In fact, just her presence as being as part of the Corps of Discovery made a lot of native tribes actually be like, oh, okay, this is a peaceful expedition. Because they brought tons of gifts to give to the native, different native tribes. Everything from, like, one of the this is the fourth episode in the series. You know, this is the one where it's supposed to be more tangential. They gave them, like, a bunch of beads. They gave them a bunch of tobacco, all this stuff. But they also, the Jefferson administration was like, here's a bunch of peace medals. Give these peace medals to these native tribes. Which is like just ignoring culture. I mean, mm-hmm. like here's a peace medal. Like, what does this mean?
I know,
like,
right?
Why are you giving this to me? Is there a war medal? Is there like a kind of medal? So luckily, Sacagawea bailed them out of most issues. And also, her and Clark were instrumental because Clark had a lot of respect for Sacagawea. And because he was in charge of the relations with the Americans and mapping and stuff like that, they work together very closely, and there's a lot of mutual respect, and we'll see that pop up in some of the side stories.
See, you say they had a lot of respect for each other, but why did they not want to bring her with them whenever they had like encounters with natives? It almost seems like they kept trying to hide her in the back, like they were afraid of showing her off, when really, like, hey, that's your best asset while you're out here. Put that front and center.
I think that's probably more of a male, like a man-woman societarial role. It's important to remember that like Clark and Lewis both come from military hierarchy structures, so I don't know if that would even, regardless of if she was a man
I always
or
wondered
a
woman, if it was like
that.
They were just worried about putting her in danger. But she didn't strike me as the type of person who'd give a shit about that.
No, she was a badass. She probably, I don't think she would have cared.
No, she would not.
But again, you got to think about it. You have a pregnant woman, and you're going across the United States, and you're not sure if these tribes are going to be friendly or not. I mean, I'm not saying I get it, but I get it.
That might look bad, I guess, too.
Yeah.
You're carrying around a 16-year-old pregnant native who's married to your French cook.
Who bought her?
Yeah. Yeah, that
could
be problematic.
Yeah, overall, that becomes very problematic the more we add adjectives to that. No, I get it.
Yeah, sure.
Another member of the group was this, was one of Clark brought one of his slaves with him, a gentleman named York, who actually became... A lot of reports that he's the first African American to ever, cross the continent.
Mm-hmm.
He was very interesting because he was just very talented. He was like an expert hunter. He was a very incredibly gifted craftsman. He was just really cool. The records just refer to him as York. Then you had Charbonnet. Which was Sacagawea's, can I say husband? I don't know if husband's appropriate to say that.
Is there another word for that? Benefactor, maybe?
I don't know. he was a French-Canadian fur trader. He was kind of cool because a lot of the natives, because there were so many Catholic missionaries in former, like the former French area of Canada, that a lot of them spoke French.
Yeah, so, he ended up being like one of the major translators on that whole trip, didn't he?
Yeah, it's
between him
cool
and his wife. Yeah,
yeah, it's kind of cool because it's like you. There was a pretty prominent European language there, especially in the roles of economic trade. A lot of these native groups, they traded French for fur trappers, so they knew the language pretty well.
That makes me think that like picking out Baptiste there was a calculated decision, not just because of his ability to cook. I think they wanted him for that that trade knowledge.
Yeah, and he was a lazy, lazy dude. He was so lazy. Like, he was lazy enough to where, like, both Lewis and Clark, but I think a lot, mostly Clark, were like, this dude is so lazy and is, like, completely useless.
So French.
He was just, like enough to where, like, some dude's like, I gotta take time out of my, like, transversing the U.S., the continental U.S. to write down how lazy this dude. Imagine, like, writing, be like, I discovered, my 100th tree, new tree species. This French dude is super lazy. Like, I do very much.
Did he name anything after him? Like, any tortoises or anything?
Yeah, that would be really funny.
Yeah, no, right. Just...
Jean Baptiste, so Sacagawea's son, was actually born during. Obviously, she was pregnant when they left. It took 18 months. She was born during. He was born during the expedition. So what's funny is that one gentleman died during the expedition. And then, obviously, they had a child who was born. So, actually, like, the same number of people.
Yeah.
Like, netted out.
As an economist looking at that, you think, oh, yeah, no net change.
Yeah. No net change. It's over. Yeah. Success.
Right.
The widowed family's, like, crying. I'm like, no, you don't understand. It's net zero.
Balance is restored.
There's no marginal impact. My favorite member of the expedition, though we don't know too much about his life prior, is Clark's dog, Seaman. He had a giant Newfoundland dog that accompanied them down the road. William Clark had brought him with him. He was absolutely beloved. Like, dude, he was like the fact that there's not a Disney movie about this dog is fascinating. We got a movie about Balto, but we don't get a movie about him.
Sounds like we need to write that one.
Though I do say, so there's a thing in like history we talk about, like, just because something's a first-hand account doesn't mean it's accurate. And they said he's a good hunting dog. And I'm like, it's a Newfoundland. It's like, it's not a hunting dog. It's a giant, like, it looks like a bear, don't get me wrong, but I don't think it's like hunting pheasants for you and stuff. It's not a beagle.
Yeah, but has anybody seen a dog like that out here? Like, when you're something new into a wilderness like that, you tend to get a lot more leeway. Like, things don't know how to react around you.
Yeah, yeah.
So this giant, doofy, fun-loving dog wandering around
in
the cornfields of Nebraska, it may not raise so many red flags, you know?
Don't give me that. Then we had, most of the people are minor after this. They brought a scout with them named George Droulard. He was of Shawnee descent, but he was half French too. You know, knew both French and Shawnee, and he was just excellent scout. But he had a lot of experience in the area. John Ordway, he was a sergeant who had served with, I believe he served with Meriwether prior to this. And he was kind of like managed the supplies and day-to-day operations among all the enlisted men. He was like, he was really what you think of as a sergeant.
Was there, I'm trying to remember if there was any like factions between, like, were some of the people like pro Clark and some people pro Meriwether?
They thought,
or were
they thought that was going to happen, but I think, at the end of the expedition when, they all got together to vote on where they should, set up fort for the winter, we didn't really see any factionization.
No, yeah.
And what's cool is that when they had the vote of where to establish their fort when they got to Oregon, it was the first time they actually let Sacagawea and York both vote. And it's actually one of the first times that we actually see women and African Americans being allowed to have their opinion heard in a democratic process.
It's the least they could do.
Yeah, I know, right? It's like, thank you to the two most probably vital people to this expedition. But it is an interesting part of American history. You have Patrick Gass. What's cool with him is he's not like, he wasn't like, mentioned everything. He's a side character, absolute side character. except he was dope at building canoes. He was just like, like, so, but the reason I like Patrick Gass is that he's a good businessman. So he was, he got promoted to sergeant. Well, he, during the expedition, he was like wicked good worker, excellent carpenter, very excellent writer. But he didn't write like a scientific, his journal didn't read like a scientific journal. It actually read like how you and I would write a journal, right?
How to make a canoe, basically.
Yeah. Yep. He, the minute they got back, he like published his journal. So he was like the first one to hit the market with like, what happened to this dog expedition? And I'm like, I love this dude. This dude was just like, hold on a minute. Well, you guys do all your like scientific advancement. I'm going to make a ton of money selling this book.
Yeah. I don't worry. I don't care about fact checking.
Yeah, no, right?
I'm just the tag along.
I am the facts.
You're right.
He lived to 1870. He died he died a little after his 99th birthday.
See, that's one thing I remember. The it was actually like the group that put together this, everybody from this expedition, they kind of like drifted apart afterwards. And I remember, I think it was Meriwether or one of the two was like trying to go back and like check up on people like 5 or 10 years after the fact.
Yeah.
And like a lot of them like just couldn't find anything about them.
Yeah. So William Clark, he tried to, Meriwether Lewis took his life in 1809.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right about that. Meriwether. I'm sorry. Clark
was the one trying to do it. Yeah.
Yeah, try to do it. But yeah, I think that's crazy that this dude just lived to like 1870. like that's absolutely wild to me. and he was born in 1771. He was, I believe he was the second oldest person. He was the third oldest person on the expedition when it left. And he lived to the 1870.
That's so like, wild.
Oh, I was on Lewis the Clark expedition. I also was around when the White House got like electricity. That's just so what.
That's like somebody who was like 100 like in 1980s, who's yeah. like watched the moon landing, but also was old enough to like traverse the Oregon Trail on a wagon.
Yeah, you're like almost in your 40s when World War I starts, and you live to see the Concorde flight. Like, yeah. Oh my God, this train's going 40 miles an hour. This is way too fast. I'm going to throw up. Supersonic jet travel, like,
yeah,
insane. The only person to die during the entire expedition was Charles Floyd, who was also had the rank of the sergeant. Pretty much everybody we talk about is like sergeant or higher, just because those are people who were like remembered by history. I don't mean to be
so. How there could have been died? Some privates that died. We just don't. They're not worth the ink.
Yeah, right. We do know nobody else died.
Okay.
What do you think Charles Floyd died of?
Dysentery. Okay. Cholera.
These are all things I would get. Appendicitis. Just bad draw. Just bad draw.
That's unlucky.
Would have died if he was in New York at the time. Like, I had appendicitis. It was not super fun. There was the Reuben brothers, the Field brothers, Joseph and Reuben, who were just brought for their hunting skills. They're just like amazing hunters. One of my favorite ones is that they brought this guy named Pierre, who is a musician. Yeah, that was his big thing. And they're like, they sit on like the transcript. He was a boatman, but from all accounts, he was just there to like, yo, dude, play some music.
Wait, boatman or bosun?
No, they said it did said boat. It said literally boats men. Because isn't bowsman, isn't that like a naval term?
Yeah, that's what I was curious. It's like kind of confusing.
Yeah, I mean literally the word boatman, which feels that somebody scribbled that down trying to convince them why they needed a musician.
I think probably just like, what other skills do you have that we could write down to justify your payment?
They definitely told Ordaway, who was the guy managing like day-to-day operations. They're like, hey, Ordaway, we need a how do you pronounce it? Bossman?
Bosun?
Bosun.
Boatsman? Boatsman?
They were like, he's like, what did he say? He's like, I didn't hear him. Boatman. They're Navy people. They mean boatman. Man. Like, just an Army guy, like, mishearing it. Yeah, and then there were some more interpreters and some lower-ranking people, but that was pretty much the expedition.
I remember, the one thing that I remember, like, standing out from that was, like, right off the bat, there was confusion over like which way to even go. I remember that there was trying to determine which river to even follow, and there was a moment where like half the crews were split. Like half the people wanted to go one way, half the people wanted to go the other way, and it was up to Mary Lewis to figure out like the best solution. I think what he ended up doing is just parking everyone there and said, you know what, I'm just going to go explore this river for a week and tell you what I find.
So, yeah, Kyle, there was so much scout work put into this.
Yeah.
They didn't really know where they didn't know where they were going. What's even worse, they didn't really have a preconceived notion of what they were going to find.
Right.
So, what's important to remember here is that there weren't the Midwest we think of today, this territory we think of today. Yes, the Rockies are relatively the same, but there wasn't really what we think of the prairie today is not what the prairie really looked like. Agricultural practices have really changed what the prairie looks like. I mean, this is obviously 100 years, 125 years before the Dust Bowl. So when you went through prairie grass, you would occasionally see what, cottonwood trees and stuff like that. But it was very tall prairie grass. I don't mean tall like to your knee. I mean like almost your height in prairie grass. Mm-hmm. There hadn't been massive deforestation yet. So, right now, what they went through, the type of forest or the land they went through, the fauna they went through, I should say, and the flora they went through was maybe there's a small fraction percentage of what it looks like today.
I don't know if this is true or not, but maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember reading that there's actually more trees in the western United States now, thanks to the logging industry, than there was when Lewis and Clark crossed it.
So that wouldn't surprise me, because trees are, you can print trees really quick, but there's a huge difference between a forest and just a bunch of trees.
Yeah. They're not the same trees.
It's funny. I actually took a class when I was doing my geoscience minor specifically on this, and I made a similar comment about that. And the guy teaching class, great man, he was like, you can move through a pre-planted tree, plantation, whatever you want to call it, quite easily. He goes, forests are just messy. The root structures and everything. They hold so much soil and sediment. That's why pretty much we had the Dust Bowl, was because we had stripped a lot of the native grasses. Yeah. So they're drudging through this, but it's not easy. But they use these scouts to try and figure out their ways through. During this time period, they discover over 300 different plant species, dozens and dozens of new animal species. And they really kind of set that precedent of this, safe, the scientific, peaceful scientific research. But I think, the best stories always come from humans interacting with other humans. And about midway through the journey, as, they're conducting these scouting operations, just like you mentioned, Kyle, is they come upon a native group and they start trading and talking, and they're able to understand each other. And somebody describes to the group what a grizzly bear is. Now, grizzly bears seem pretty terrifying. If you ask me, I've spent a little bit of time in the woods, not a lot, and I think I'm pretty decently scared of grizzly bears. So they hear these stories from different Native Americans, and they start talking about these white bears. They're called white bears, and they're like,
sounds like polar bears.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be wild if they came down that far. That'd be so terrifying. I hope that's not funny, right? They don't come down that far. Right? Call Joel. See if Alberta has grizzly bears polar bears.
I think Kodiak bears are terrifying enough.
Yeah, but so these grizzly bears, these white bears show up, and you know what the first thing they said to the Native Americans were? They were like,
"Can we shoot one?"
Yeah, they're like, can we hunt one?
What does it taste like?
Yeah. So, the Native Americans are like, I don't recommend it.
Don't miss.
Yeah. So they go in the woods and they're like, we're going to go, find this grizzly bear. And they head out there. And this is the first time they ever see a grizzly bear. And they're like, all right, great. And one of the guys, we don't know who, shoots the grizzly bear. And it charges them. And they shoot it again. Grizzly bears not caring. Goes and goes. They had to flee from the grizzly bear, and they kept shooting it. And after half a dozen rounds, it finally just collapsed from its injuries.
Yeah.
And they were like, we're not doing that ever again.
All right. Well, we could check that one off the list, but
it actually made them respect animals more as they went through the rest of their journey, because they were like, That was terrifying. Like, and you got to remember at this point in time, like these are muskets. These are like 50 plus caliber,
right?
Like rounds. These
rounds are no joke.
Yeah, like they're, it's a lot of gunpowder in these things too. Like these aren't little. Like these will mess you up. But yeah, so they end up like just being terrified of that for the rest of the time.
Jesus.
My part I find kind of funny about it is that I'm assuming they weren't able to like preserve it because they had hit it so many times.
Oh my God. So apparently there are about 2/3 of the world's population of polar bears are in Canada. They primarily live along the Arctic coast and the Hudson Bay in provinces and territories like Nunavut, the Northwest Territories, Manitoba, which is right north of that North Dakota, I think. Notably around Churchill, which is also known as the polar bear capital of the world, Ontario, Quebec, the northernmost parts. So yeah, a lot of polar bears in Canada. All right, so no more hunting bears on the trip after this one. They got it out of their system with the one.
All right, so they got out of their system. Shortly afterwards, they run into... Well, this is actually Kyle's, I think, one
this
of Kyle's
favorite stories.
This is my favorite
story, I think. Yeah.
So they run into Chief Kamehwat. Kamehwat.
Sure.
I don't know how to pronounce that. And so they show up. And he's a Shoshone leader. Now, remember, Sacagawea was kidnapped as a young girl.
This is a very tense standoff, too, wasn't it? Like, they were not sure what the intentions were of either side.
Yeah. So they're like, you know, not really sure what's going on. No, she's staring at this. You know, what's funny is that, if you know, I've seen, like, theatrical representations of this. They make it like she runs over and she's like, oh, it's my brother. Like, oh, it's this big family reunion and all that stuff. Yeah, but they're having this tense standoff. And Kyle, you mentioned earlier, like, you know, Lewis and Clark would be the people to go up to, you know, to kind of not negotiate, but formally introduce themselves and stuff like that. And so it's kind of tense. They kind of don't know, like, kind of what's going on. Now, it's important to remember that, like, you know, we tend to say Native Americans, and that's improper to say, you know, these are all individual groups with their individual histories and individual stuff. Now, I just mentioned to you, one thing we just talked about is that, like, people getting kidnapped, like people getting stolen, and you have these group of random guys who show up out of the woods. They're shooting grizzly bears and a bunch of weapons and stuff. Like, if I came home and there's some dudes in my backyard, like, you know, trying to trap squirrels, I'd be like, whoa, can you get out of my property? I'm not gonna, I don't want to talk to them. I just want them to leave me alone. And then, you know, if somebody like kidnapped my cat earlier on, I'd be like, oh, these are, leave me alone. I don't want to deal with any of this stuff.
Can I have my cat back, please?
My cat back, please. Very much like my cat.
So
as they're having this kind of like tense, like, it's not, I don't want to make it think like it's all, you know, knives out and everything like that, but it's just like, hey, leave us the heck alone. We want to be, you know, left alone. Secondary is like, it's funny how some historians have described it, because she doesn't go like, oh, Eureka, that's my brother. She's like, she looks at him, because like, there's a huge, you know, long time had passed since she was a kid, and she talks about remembering, not necessarily, I want to phrase this right, because how they worded it. It's not like she's saying, oh, I remember, you know, playing in the, you know, in the yard with this guy growing up and all that stuff. It was like she remembers the term, the phrasing that I saw a lot was that she remembers him with her and her mother. And I don't know why I like that language so much. Like, instead of just saying like the sibling, like the family structure she remembers. And, you know, and he, and so she goes over to him and is like, you know, talk
hey.
To him.
Hey, what have you been up to?
And, you know, he loses it. He can't believe this because he remembers his sister being kidnapped by, you know, another tribe. And like, they probably thought she was dead.
Yeah.
Like, and so he's like, I mean, to him, Lewis and Clark are like, even though they had nothing to do with this, but to him, they're like, oh my God, you brought my sister back. Like, this is like immediately like 180.
See, you can go two ways with that. It could be the, oh, you brought my sister back. Or it could be a, oh, you're the monsters who captured my sister and took them away from us.
Yes. My only caveat to that is that they knew it was a native.
Sacagawea was there, I think, probably giving her side of the story, and I think she probably gave him a much better version.
But it's also important to remember that it was a native tribe that originally kidnapped her, And that these tribes all kidnapped, not all of them, but it was common for Native American tribes to kidnap each other. So it wasn't like they were like, oh, like, clearly they looked at Lewis and Clark and were like, you're clearly not Native Americans. Hasty white people.
How freaking wild is that, though, to just be wandering around in this new territory that you just purchased and about to go down, but luckily the lady that you brought along with you just happens to be brothers with the chief that you're talking to.
Yeah. Do you think it was also awkward when they said to whatever chief they ran into, like, oh, we just bought this land? They were like, what?
Yeah, no, right? Yeah. Here's some beads. Forget about it.
Yeah. Do you think they just didn't bring that up in conversation?
I wouldn't have brought it up.
I wouldn't have brought it up either. I'd just be like,
actually, that was, though, something. Because I think they were tasked with, like, going around and telling all these tribes that, hey, now you belong to, like, you're now part of the U.S. You're subjects of the United States. Like, you have to.
That was part of, like, their orders. I'm just saying they just lied about it. Like,
well, yeah,
I have no evidence of that. I'm just telling you what I would do. I'd be like, oh, cool, I'm leaving.
Nobody's going to fact check you, yeah.
Yeah, I'd be like, that's somebody else's problem. That's not my problem.
So you want to go tell all these people that you bought their land that they've been living on for the last 1,000 years? Well, yeah, okay, sure, I'll do that.
Yep, that's good. But I can. Is anybody going to come in here and talk to them?
Is anybody going to follow up before? But in the next 50 years.
Yeah. So they have this encounter, and then they head into. Just before they head into the Great Lakes, Meriwether Lewis and some of the enlisted men are out hunting, and one of them shoots Meriwether. Lewis in the thigh, like,
ooh, the thigh,
square in the thigh, like, and he survived. Yeah, and you know, luckily that was towards the end of the expedition, but you know, still slowed them down a little bit. One of my favorite parts about this, and we talked, I think, about this a little bit on the last show, is they just complete and utter disrespect for the Rocky Mountains.
yeah, we'll get over that in like a day, a week, a month.
So if anything kind of epitomizes it, it's their trek through what were called the Bitterroots Mountains, where they got trapped in, I don't want to say they got trapped in a storm, they kind of got trapped in like what you expect the Rockies to be like at this time of
year. Yeah, they were like trapped for like all winter, right? Like they thought like, oh, we'll just push through this, it'll be no problem. Like, no, you're going to sit there for a while.
Towards the end of this, as like the weather started to break, I want to call it winter. I don't really want to call it a storm because you're right, Kyle. This isn't just something that's like 20, a few days long. This is like lasting a long time. They had to eat their horses to survive, and then eventually had to eat candle wax.
Wow, I don't think I've ever been that hungry.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm just gonna look up the nutritional value of a candle.
I think about the nutritional value of a horse. I was like, probably a lot. I mean, I feel like horses are pretty big animals.
Horses, probably. Essentially, no nutritional value. The wax is undigestible, provides no usable nutrients. Though beeswax is technically edible, it offers negligible nutritional value due to their indigestible nature. So really, if you're eating that, you're just trying to fill your stomach up so you don't feel hungry.
Yeah. Fiber. A lot of fiber.
Yeah. Kind of.
Yeah, and you know, just for reference, the Bitterroot Mountains are in Idaho, which I think everybody knows how bad winters can be in Idaho. Now imagine that with like you thought it was going to be the Appalachian Mountains, which as somebody who I'm literally wearing a shirt that says West Virginia, so I spent a little bit of time in Appalachia. Appalachian Mountains are beautiful. It's all forest and nice. Yeah. Rocky Mountains are scary. They're like absolutely terrifying.
And these guys were out, you know, like. Sundaying around Bunker Hill is like part of their preparation for the Rockies, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep. Pretty much. Fun random fact about the Appalachian Mountains. They are older than the rings of Saturn.
Okay. I would try to fact check you on that, but I don't feel qualified.
Honestly, fact check me on that because that's one of my favorite random facts. It's like the John Denver song, you know, Take Me Home Country Roads, where they go, you know, younger than the mountains, older than the trees. It's like, yeah, no, it is. The Appalachian Mountains are older than trees. Huh. I just like that.
Older than trees.
Yeah, but trees are relatively new on the geological time frame. Don't know how we got to that on an episode of Lewis and Clark.
I know, right? Especially because we need to start wrapping this one up here.
No, we're almost there. Yeah. So the Nez Perce tribe, they were the... so they eventually found them, helped them, got them food, got them up and running. Dude, this whole Lewis and Clark expedition is basically like Sacagawea and other native tribes dragging helping these dudes to the finish line.
Yeah.
Like dragging these dudes. And I don't mean to be mean about losing. Like they were great explorers, great scientists. Don't get me wrong.
But I imagine that this is probably what happened to Lewis and Clark while they're out there. They're probably out cataloging plants and other things, and some other buddy, Sacagawea's over there in the corner, like, guys, it's getting kind of late into autumn. We should probably get some food packed up. Maybe get some.
Did you see this bird?
Miles going. Yeah. 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 Exactly. Please stop sketching all the trees and start.
Yeah. Real quick, I'm going to shoot this grizzly bear. Stop hunting grizzly bears.
We lost a month because of that.
We lost a month and we couldn't use any of the meat. So as the expedition starts to wind down, and again, like a lot of the stuff we learn in school, we really try on this show to talk more about the side aspects of it. It's important to remember that nobody knew where the hell they were. They could have just fallen off the world. They didn't know what the heck was on the other side. There were some people, one of the weird parts is people were like, I thought there were still dinosaurs out there. Nobody thought there were still dinosaurs. No. They thought there might have been mammoths or other animals that they knew existed. We just didn't know if they were still in the world. But nobody thought there was going to be a velociraptor cruising around out there.
Thank God there wasn't.
At this point in time, most people didn't even know dinosaurs even existed. We had just started discovering dinosaur bones. Sally had just started selling seashells at the seashore, which is what that nursery rhyme is about. It's about one of the first paleontologists.
I'm in note of that.
Yeah, that's very weird. Extra Credit History did a whole episode on it, and it sounds like an April Fool's joke as they're explaining it, and even during it. They're sorry. I think he made a joke on their Twitter or Patreon. That was
that's hilarious.
We're dead serious is what this is about. One of my favorite things I learned, because I got to bring everything back to Quincy, Mary Had a Little Lamb was a real person.
Yeah.
And she advocated for the opening of the first commercial railroad in the United States, which was in Mount Quincy, because her father was one of the veterans of the Bunker Battle Hill, and that's where the first granite was mined to build that monument. And so she showed up to the state house and was like, hey, I'm Mary from Mary Had a Little Lamb, which I don't know how popular that was.
That's a great way to introduce yourself.
Is that Taylor Swift showing up somewhere in the early 1800s?
I don't know.
How popular was her? I think of Mary Had a Little Lamb as this hinky song. And was she royalty? I don't know. I don't know how pop culture royalty was back then.
How did music work back then? Because there's five songs general, right?
Yeah. Which, if there's only five songs and your namesake is one of them, you're right.
Yeah. I think you're golden.
You're golden. All right. Yeah. So she advocated for that. So nursery rhymes have low key had a pretty big impact on. We'll tell you real history occasionally. Please, please don't believe that.
So going back to real history, then one of the things that I always thought fascinating about this whole expedition is that word of the success of the expedition managed to get back to Jefferson and everyone else before they got back. Because they happened to run into a ship on the Pacific Ocean that was able to carry a message for him.
Yeah. So that's exactly. So that's the only way they were able to, that was the only real form of communication.
Yeah, there's no real plan, really, was there?
No, and I believe they actually got back to St. Louis before any news had even before any mail had gotten back.
I wouldn't doubt that.
Because I'm going Cape of Good Hope. But one of my favorite parts about that, so they get back to they get back to St. Louis. It still took weeks to get back to Jefferson. And the gentleman we talked about earlier, Gass, who published the first book, he was already stopping fucking. He was on it, dude.
He was over there cutting deals with the Canadians.
Yeah, I'm Team Gass. I'm just telling you right now, that dude's probably my favorite guy I read about the entire expedition. Because everybody liked him. He was a good hunter. He was a good boat builder. He was this really good carpenter. Could fix anything in the world. Helped build the fort when they got there. But the whole time, he was just I'm going to be the first person to publish this. You jabroni's going to be talking about your stupid birds and turtles you found. And Chabonet is just being a lazy jerk. And I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna be that guy. But yeah, it was. Yeah, so they get back. Jefferson's obviously very, very excited. It's a huge national success. Everybody loves it. What's even funny is the residents were of St. Louis were like mm-hmm. super invested in this. Like they would hold watch parties. They
They're just waiting for them to come back.
Yeah, because a lot of them, you know, the Corps of Discovery, you know, they had been vital in that community. This was seen as like national prestige. Like yeah. we mentioned last episode, Louisiana Purge was hugely popular in the United States, and you know they had helped this team form everything up. But they knew how uncertain this was. And nobody knew how long it was going to take. And so there's some stories, like contemporary reports. And again, contemporary reports doesn't mean it's accurate, but there was contemporary reports of like people just essentially just always being on guard, mm-hmm. Just staring west, hoping that they would see them coming. They made it back, and the rest is history. I mean, there was a ton of other expeditions. There was three major subsequent.
The Oregon Trail migrations that happened later in the 1800s. Was the starting point St. Louis, and was that because of where they managed to start the Lewis and Clark expedition from?
It was St. Louis. It was Independence, Missouri the starting point, but yeah, that's where it started from, because you really can't replicate the geography of St. Louis with the river access, and then naturally you eventually had railroads and went through there, and with railroads comes telegraphs, and so after Lewis and Clark, there's really just three major. Well, there was tons and tons of expeditions, but there's three major. They're all named after each other. So my favorite one is the Long Expedition, because that's it's named after a guy, Steve Long, which is named my one of my favorite uncles. It was Steve Long. He passed away. He's a great, absolutely great guy. So it's my favorite, A, because it's named after my uncle, and B, because imagine if you showed up to the Long Expedition. God damn it, I wanted the Short Expedition.
I know, right?
It's funny. It was just one of the shortest expeditions that they went out, and they mapped like the Great Plains all the way up to the Rockies. It was like super useful for farming and for land sales later on. But one of the I like this. All right, you know me, I'm a pedantic man. They labeled it the Great American Desert. That's what they labeled the Great Plains, and
the Deseret.
Well, they meant a desert because of lack of rain.
Sorry. Yeah, yeah.
No, I'm done with whatever Utah was supposed to be called. I'm happy I got four letters, honestly.
I'm sorry. Couldn't resist that one.
Yeah, right. But that's what they meant, because there was a devoid of rainfall. So just people didn't move there for several years. And then later they had the Wilkes Expedition, which the U.S. Navy, like their science corps, they were like, yo, go out there and try and figure out if there's, you know, let's search for the Pacific, explore the Pacific Northwest and ocean, Oregon Territory and all that. And the Wilkes Expedition was like, hey, real quick, you know the thing the guy labeled as a desert? Yeah, it's a prairie.
Right.
They're like, oh, okay. And the guy's like, no, that means it's not, there's grass. It's clearly not
habitable.
Desert. Yeah, like, here's the guys, we can move here. What do we do?
What area did you say that was? Like around like South Dakota? Is that why South Dakota is so desolate still to this day? Because everyone was afraid to move up there?
I thought South Dakota was just like massive agricultural area. That's why like nobody was around there, because everybody's like, I'm going to grow a bunch of stuff here. I don't know much about South Dakota.
I don't know. I thought South Dakota's all like oil and dinosaur bones.
Yeah. Yeah, right? South Dakota listeners, can you like chime in and tell us you're wrong?
Tell me I'm wrong, please.
Why? I don't know why there's two Dakotas. I know why there's a North and South Carolina. I know why there's an East. I was going to say East and West Virginia. I'm going to stand by that, actually, why there's a Virginia and West Virginia. I'm sorry. Team is stuck with the Union. Take that, Virginia.
Oh, God.
As somebody from Massachusetts who, you know, the old joke, like, oh, the first six presidents, they were from Virginia and named John Adams. And then went to West Virginia University. I don't know, Virginia. I'm looking at you. I don't know.
All right.
Sorry. And the final one was, I'll end on this one. The final one was the Friedmund Expedition. That occurred just prior to, like, 1853 was when it ended. That lasted 11 years. It was one of the longest expeditions. It mapped out the Oregon Trail, all the Sierra Nevadas, and pretty much every part of the West that hadn't been used yet, that hadn't been mapped yet, but it formed the major trails that were used to settle California.
God, I would not want to be the one mapping out all those mountain trails. It's like, yeah, I know we need to spend 11 years doing this, but can we spend like 9 of them in, you know, east of Kansas,
please? What if they're just chilling in San Diego for 9 years?
Right. Like, we've really got to get this coastline right, guys. This is going to be a huge port here.
Would you find a glass bottle bear in the 1840s? Worry about it.
All right, so I think we've got, a POTUS scale is what we came up with. So what we need is personal character or political influence. How do you want to rank Jefferson's ability to shape political landscape, including their impact on party dynamics, legislative agendas, and long-term political shifts?
Oh, he's a 7. Oh, it's 1 to 7, right?
Yeah, you're talking about Jefferson?
Yeah.
Okay.
Wait, hold on.
What's saying ability to shape the political landscape, including their own impact on party dynamics, legislative agendas, and long-term political shifts.
He founded his own political party.
Okay.
So that's why I would say it. Political shift.
So you're saying 7 for that, huh?
I'm saying 7 for that. And the reason I'm saying 7 for that is... party dynamics. He founded his own party. Agenda, I mean, the Embargo Act was horrible, but he got that passed, which is crazy. Think about that. Purchased, double the size.
So you're giving him credit for
time.
Passing shitty legislation.
We were supposed to ding him for that.
No. Okay, all right, fair enough. I'm on team seven. All right, all right. Okay, fair enough. Overall governance, then. Assess the effectiveness of his administration in implementing policies, managing the bureaucracy, and maintaining stability in governance. That one you can probably ding him a bit.
Yeah, stability in government. He did not do a good job at that. Like, he defunded the...
Defending the Navy?
Real quick, are we able to use hindsight for these? Like, can I say, like, he did X thing and that caused Y thing later on?
I'd say so.
Oh, yeah, he defunded the Navy. Then we ended up fighting a war that caused Washington, D.C. to get burnt down.
Because Canadians. Yeah, like, who's to say that the decision to defund the Navy isn't what actually led to that war being possible, too, right?
I think it did. They were like, oh, you have a weak Navy. Let me come up there and, have fun with you. And we're just like, oh, crap, we don't have the Navy.
Scale 1 to 7. Where are you going to stick him?
Overall governance. He was an effective president. He got stuff passed. But this is where you can ding, because the Embargo Act was crappy. Is he a 4? Is he actually a 4?
I think that's as high as you can put him.
I do think that's as high as you can put him, because he got stuff done, and I do think that that's part of being an effective administrator. But man, he kept guessing bad.
I'm going three? Okay.
Yeah, I'm going 3. I'm driving it down.
I was going to lobby for that, but all right. Transformational leadership. His capacity to enact significant changes or reforms that alter the course of history. I mean, yeah, he kind of did that.
Yeah.
Did they address pressing societal issues and implement lasting change?
They definitely implemented lasting change. I don't know if they addressed pressing social issues, if anything but inflamed. I'll give them credit for ending the slave trade and sticking to that in the Constitution. That was a shock.
Again, how much credit can you give somebody who does something after they've already realized all the benefits for themselves?
Yeah, but are we talking about him as a person or him as a president?
Either or.
I think
As a
president, I'd give him credit for it. As a person, absolutely not.
Okay. Right.
Yeah. Well, would you know that? It is hard to separate him from the...
God, it is, isn't it?
It is, because you're just like, oh, he did this. He invented the swivel chair. It's like, he didn't free his children who were slaves. It's like, oh, jeez. Like,
right.
A horrible person. I'm going to give him a 5 on that.
All right, I think that's fair.
The Louisiana Purchase is so hard to
that
argue
is,
with.
If you want to give him a 6, I'd even let you bump him up another one.
I'll go 6. I'll take you up on that. I'll take the 6.
All right, understanding of public needs. How well did he understand and respond to the needs and concerns of the public? Did they engage with citizens and address their priorities effectively?
I think we're going to have a hard time with this one with the earlier presidents, just because the presidency hadn't fully, cured yet. Like, we didn't know what it was supposed to be. But with that said, I want did he understand their needs? I don't think he was concerned about the needs. He wanted low budgets. He didn't want a standing military. He didn't want any of that. But I also think it's a disservice to say, because he focused so much on, well, I don't want to say liberty, because again, he had a bunch of slaves, on the liberty side of that, I think that is addressing a need in a sense, like just letting people do what they want to do.
Yeah.
I'll split the deck. I'll give him a 4 on this, because I don't think he was like cared what the constituents thought. I think he was looking at it more, the United States as a one entity.
I mean, is there anything that they asked him to do that he wasn't doing? Is there any campaign promises that were unfulfilled? Is there
his campaign promise was like, I don't like John Adams.
That sounds like
the he got rid of John Adams. I mean, that's I guess he fulfilled that campaign.
I mean, that's kind of all the public wanted, wasn't it?
yeah, but I am biased, and these are not scientific, right? Like, I'm not gonna be held accountable. Like when I get to Lincoln, I give all 7s. And Eisenhower, we'll get all 7s.
I was actually wondering if we shouldn't re-rank this instead of doing a POTUS scale and just, you know, we're just gonna rank our Mount Rushmore.
Oh,
so like in this case right now, we've gotten through 3 presidents. He's on Mount Rushmore because even if he's the 3rd worst, there's still. Yes. 4 spots up for grabs, so he's still there. We just figure who's going to get bumped the next time we do another one.
Oh, that's not a bad one. Jefferson out, Adams in. Get at me.
Well, I mean, there's only 3 presidents we've covered so far, so all 3 are on there.
No, I'm just saying when this is all done, I'm going to horribly tilt my scale. I'm going to start like lower ranking other presidents.
I feel like I still want to have this ranking, so I mean, it probably doesn't hurt to go through it.
Both.
I feel like that could be useful for something, but maybe we just streamline this to... Once we get to 4, then we can start looking at it as our Rushmore.
I like that. Okay, I'm on to that.
All right. So then let's get through. So 5 for understanding public needs, you said?
Yes.
And then strategic vision. Examine the clarity, ambition of the president's vision for the country. Did they have a forward-thinking approach that guided their decisions and inspired hope for the future?
No. No.
How bad do you want to dang this one?
He was like... He was like a blind mouse. He didn't know what he was doing. He was like, can I buy land? Like, we'll do the Embargo Act. It's not weird that I wrote that all men are entitled to liberty and then did nothing in my private life to show that. One? I don't think he had any strategy. He, like, defunded the Navy. I don't think he figured anything out.
No.
Yeah, no.
Wow. That's a pretty...
I'm going to get lit up for that one, but I am I wrong here, Kyle? No. You went through this with me. Like,
no, I think we're pretty fair.
I just feel like he did. I'm trying to think of, like, to me, a strategic vision is like, I'm going to do X, and then I'm going to think about what I'm going to do, and I'm going to make sure it's in line with what I can do. And everything was hypocrisy. Yeah. Everything was like, I want to do this. And then he was literally not doing that in his private life. He fled Monticello. He fled the capital of Virginia.
Right.
Like, during an invasion. And, like, didn't do that well. He defunded the Navy. And then, like, if D.C. gets burned to the ground.
Right.
Louisiana Purchase. He, like, kind of just sent somebody over and said, negotiate $10 million for it. He didn't, like, know what to do with it afterwards.
Yeah, he hadn't ever thought to explore it before he bought it.
Yeah, no, yeah, he never did a lap around the house just to make sure, you know, he didn't have a home inspector come out there.
Right. Okay, well, I think that gives us our ranking. So we're going with a 7, 3, 6, 5, and 1 for a total of 22 out of a max score of 35. I think that's the worst we've graded a president so far. But if you disagree, let us know where you disagree. I think you're going to have a hard time convincing us that he deserves anything higher than 1 for strategic vision. But
yeah, I don't know what's going on. Loved it.
All right, well, I think that's probably gotten to the end. Now that we can see the deep, deep blue of the Pacific Ocean, that's probably signaling the end of our time today. I hope that we will see you guys all next week. We kick off part 1 with Madison, but in the meantime, we do want to hear from you. Where does Jefferson rank now that the spotlight has revealed multiple skeletons in his closet? Personally, I think that closet was built out of skeletons, but, you know... you can email us at thebuckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com, or you can visit buckstartsherepodcast.com. Sub on your favorite platforms to stay up to date with the show, and we'll see you all next week.